and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this episode of the podcast, number 222.
And we have never really imposed a cost that would create a deterrent. And I think particularly with people like Putin, you know, until Putin understands that there will be a significant cost to be paid, he's going to keep doing it. He's the classic playground bully who doesn't understand anything other than the, you know, language of force.
It's no news to anyone who covers the cybersecurity beat that vulnerable software and hardware pose a serious risk to critical infrastructure in the United States, and that sophisticated nation-state adversaries have made a habit of poking around inside sensitive government and corporate networks. For some reason, however, that message has mostly fallen on deaf ears on Capitol Hill. After all, the Senate first got briefed on cyber risk to the government and the economy more than 20 years ago, when members of The Loft, an early hacker collective, casually informed senators in 1998 that they could shut down the internet in 30 minutes if they wanted to. Between 1998 and today, there have been countless hearings on cyber risks, countless government reports documenting the federal government's ineptitude on matters of information security and defense. That's not to say that the ship of state isn't slowly turning with the help of lawmakers on Capitol Hill who understand cybersecurity. The 2015 Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act is a great example of that. Among other things, it created the federal government's first point agency on cybersecurity, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA. In this week's podcast, we invited one of Capitol Hill's most recognized voices on matters of information security into the studio. Congressman Jim Hines is a 7-term Democratic representative from Connecticut's 4th District. On Capitol Hill, he serves as a member of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, where he's chairman of the Strategic Technologies and Advanced Research, or STAR, subcommittee. And he serves as the ranking member of the NSA and Cybersecurity Committee. In this conversation, Congressman Himes and I talk about Congress's dawning awareness of our nation's vulnerability to cyber attacks, an awareness that the recent Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack helped cement. We also talk about the best way to counter the actions of foreign governments. I started off our conversation by asking Representative Himes about how he has seen Congress's thinking on cybersecurity change during his 7 terms in office.
Yeah, so I'm Congressman Jim Himes. I represent the 4th District of Connecticut. That's southwestern Connecticut. I'm in my 7th term and spend most of my time in Washington on intelligence issues as a member of the Intelligence Committee and on financial services issues as a member of that committee. And most recently, actually, interestingly, the Speaker of the House has asked me to chair the Committee on Economic Disparity.
Congressman, welcome to Security Ledger Podcast.
Thank you.
You have really focused in your time in Congress on cybersecurity, on the House Intelligence Committee and the NSA and cybersecurity subcommittees. Could you talk about just in your time in Congress, kind of how this topic and Congress's thinking around cybersecurity has changed?
Yeah, and change it has. I'm glad to report. Again, I've been doing this for coming on 13 years, and I would say that there's been really a dramatic change in people's level of education, sense of urgency around cybersecurity. I sometimes joke that, you know, even a decade ago, you'd have people with, you know, 3 stars on their shoulders come in front of the Homeland Security Committee or other committees, and you'd ask them about cybersecurity, and you'd get blank stares. And obviously, there's been an awful lot of water under the bridge, so to speak, since then. The federal government, as it is wont to do, arguably hasn't moved quite as rapidly as it should, but it has moved quite rapidly to stand up organizations that are about defending our cyber infrastructure, developing offensive capabilities that theoretically could be used and sometimes are used for retribution or for other operations. And perhaps most importantly, there's been really a high level of education given to members of Congress. You know, it might have taken a while. It might have been the gas lines forming in Virginia because of the Colonial Pipeline fiasco. But legislators have come to realize how very important this issue is.
Yeah. If there's any doubt before, right, people putting petroleum into plastic supermarket bags is a good, right. a good sign that, that things are going sideways a little bit. One of the issues that has really gained a lot of attention just in the last year or 18 months or so is ransomware attacks. Obviously, because they have, I mean, they've been a problem for a while, but they have increasingly focused on critical infrastructure providers of one way or another. What is your thoughts on, you know, what role, if any, Congress and the federal government can play in this problem, which affects obviously local, state, federal governments, as well as private sector entities? What's to be done about it from a policy standpoint?
Yeah, well, the answer to that is a lot. You're absolutely right. There was something about Colonial Pipelines and people in big gas lines reminiscent of the 70s that brought this home. I mean, it's not like ransomware attacks are a new thing. We saw the city of Baltimore attacked a number of years ago. And of course, we've sort of people, individuals and others have experienced this. But yeah, there was something that made it very real when the Colonial Pipeline shut down for that period of time. And so there's an awful lot more that we can all do. And you asked about the government in particular, but let me sidetrack you for 1 second and say that when you talk to the experts on this issue, whether those experts are inside the government or at groups like Gartner, they will tell you that they almost never see a zero-day attack. Right, that's a tiny percentage of malware is unknown, and so probably the biggest thing we can do as a society, and I'm sure government can help on this, is just to be a lot smarter and a lot more hygienic in how we do things, patching our software, two-factor authentication, being smarter about clicking on unknown links. I've always said that if all of us, and I don't just mean individuals out there on their laptops, this applies to corporate America too. If we were just smarter and more competent about that stuff, we would take a very big problem and make it a lot smaller. But your question was about government, and there too, I think we have a lot of work we can do. Let me tell you a story to illustrate how poor I think the teamwork is when we see a ransomware attack. I was in a hearing on the Intelligence Committee talking to very senior intelligence experts when the thing was winding down. It was reported in the press that a ransom had been paid. We were very interested to know how our three-letter agencies had been helpful and worked in partnership with Colonial Pipelines. And I asked a senior intelligence person, so do we know if they paid, press is reporting that they paid a $4 million plus ransom. Do we know if that's true or not? And the answer was, we don't know. So to me, that was just perfectly illustrative of the fact that we have a lot of work to do to really crowdsource our responses to these things, to make sure that the government is perhaps literally sitting side by side with energy companies and banks and what have you when these attacks come in. We've got a long way to go in that respect.
I mean, one of the challenges in the United States is so much of our critical infrastructure is privately owned, not publicly owned. So these are either corporations, maybe publicly traded, maybe not, that own and operate this infrastructure. And there's, obviously a long history of government kind of keeping its hands out of the private sector whenever possible. That ethos has prevailed in the past where, the government has preferred to let industry regulate itself rather than come in and do, impose security mandates or do audits and that type of thing. Do you think that we're kind of reaching an inflection point on that, given the track record of the private sector on this, which you'd have to admit is not great?
Yeah, I do. And what do I mean by that? We're actually seeing bipartisan support for ideas like mandatory breach reporting. I would suggest that 5 years ago, that probably would not have been true. There was lots of, and you still hear the private sector saying, hey, wait a minute, we're victims here. Don't treat us like we're the bad guys from the standpoint of regulation. I think more and more we're developing a more competent way of thinking about this. What I like to think of as sort of a FAA and aviation regulation way of thinking about this stuff, which is regulators working in partnership with the private sector to make sure that we're safe with things like self-reporting and mandatory reporting and that kind of thing. So yeah, I think there needs to be a little bit of a phase shift in our thinking, because as you point out, there has always been kind of a bright line between where government gets involved in partnership with the or or otherwise with the private sector. But let's face it. I mean, you know, 40 years ago when I was a kid, networks didn't exist. And so my ability to buy a quart of milk, my ability to withdraw money from a bank, my ability to get my, you know, news on the television, none of that was vulnerable to something that didn't, a threat that didn't yet exist. And now, you know, we really learned this during COVID, if we didn't know it before, you know, our level of networking is almost existential in its existence. And of course, that's only going to become more true over time. So I think without in any way, shape or form, losing a respect for the values that we have to respect, you know, the privacy of individuals. Nobody wants the FBI, you know, keeping their social security number or their whereabouts on a spreadsheet somewhere. So without in anywhere abandoning concepts of privacy, I do think we're going to need to get much more comfortable over time with the government sitting side by side with the private sector on cybersecurity issues.
Yeah. Coming back to ransomware, you mentioned the whole ransom payment thing, and I listened to some of the Colonial Pipeline hearings. Congress people often seem fixated on the payment of ransom, how it was paid, the decisions involving it being paid, the consequences of it being paid. What's your take on ransomware payments? And let me just editorialize here. I think it's kind of a dead end issue. I don't think it's the most relevant issue around ransomware, but it does seem to be a fixation of policymakers. Why do you think that is? And do you think it's actually a really important issue?
I'm with you on this. I think it's an overblown issue, and people who haven't spent a lot of time in the space and haven't maybe thought about all of the military has a term, left of boom, which is everything that leads up to a bad situation. You know, folks that haven't thought about all of the vulnerabilities and the actions that happen, you know, before a ransom is paid, sometimes sort of seize on that because it's one of the more understandable elements of this. But look, the truth is that we don't have a lot of clarity about the payment of ransom in the physical world, right? We don't say to people, if your cousin is kidnapped in Colombia, just to pick something, you can't pay ransom. We don't say that. Now, there are laws. You can't pay money to terrorists. You probably can't pay money to certain known and named criminal groups. But, it's very hard for the government to do what I think some people think it should do, which is to simply prohibit the payment of ransom. You know, this is, if you have a small business and the business has ransom, all of their data has turned up. What the government is saying, if they're saying you can't pay ransom, is that, sorry, you're gone. And I think people need to sort of grapple with that. So I agree with you. I think, you know, there's so much more we can do around about being smart in our defenses, about being united internationally to go after rogue groups that are undertaking these criminal activities. Which, by the way, I think that's a huge underexplored realm. Right? None of us are safe. Not the North Koreans. Not the Iranians. Not the Russians. Not the Chinese. None of us are safe from rogue criminal operators. So I just think there's so much more we can do before we have a very difficult argument about policies surrounding the payment of ransom.
Yeah. To that point, one of the things that the federal government has done recently is, or Congress rather, is the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, which was really an effort to talk about high level government policy vis-a-vis cybersecurity and come up with some recommendations. Can you talk a little bit about that commission and some of the recommendations that came out of it?
Yeah, it was really a terrific effort. It was bipartisan. It had knowledgeable and very practical members of Congress as well as outside experts opining, and they came up with just. It actually, unusually for a government report, it makes for really good reading as well. And you know, it makes a lot of the suggestions that that have been talked about for a long time, but it just did it obviously at a very high level with a lot of policymakers involved. You know, suggestions about better cooperation between the government and the private sector, as we've been talking about. Suggestions about making sure that we're doing everything we can to coordinate the development of norms internationally. That's not a sexy field, but you know, the UN is beavering away through the government group of experts to try to develop norms and more clarity around things like who exactly is a rogue? How do we jointly go after them? I use a lot of Cold War metaphors, and sometimes I get some blowback for that. But you know, one of the reasons we stayed safe in the Cold War, as horribly dangerous as that period was because we developed very clear doctrines around what was a act of war, what wasn't, what our procedures were for missile defense, and we shared those doctrines with our quote enemies, the Soviets, right? And they did the same with us. And as a consequence, because we knew each other's doctrines and we knew how we worked really hard to make sure we knew how we thought about the threat, the level of risk was much reduced. We don't have that today in the cyber realm, right? Nobody really knows what's an act of war versus a crime. And we've got a lot of work to do to try to get to that point where we've got sort of common agreement internationally.
Each month, the Security Ledger podcast informs and entertains an audience of thousands of technology and information security professionals. If that sounds like an audience your company is trying to reach, consider sponsoring one of our podcasts. We offer per-episode sponsorships of our weekly podcast, which features news, analysis, and discussion of the most important security topics of the day. You can also commission a custom podcast that highlights your executives, researchers, and subject matter experts. To learn more, point your web browser to securityledger.com/sponsor. I mean, one of the big kind of takeaways from that commission report was this notion of deterrence and pursuing a policy of deterrence, which is, of course, you know, if you're a student of the Cold War, was sort of the operating MO of the, you know, the West. What does that mean in the context of cyber security and cyber attacks? And what could the U.S. and its allies do to deter actors like, you know, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea from what they've been doing in recent years, which is, you know, pretty aggressive, offensive cyber operations in the U.S. and in North America and Europe?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked, because this has been a bugaboo of mine for 12 years now. I've had this argument with three different presidential administrations, and I've made the point repeatedly that one of the reasons we keep seeing these Russian and Chinese, Russian in particular, attacks on our cyber infrastructure, whether it's the DNC hack or the ongoing activities of the Russians and the Chinese, is because we don't impose a cost for them having done so. I mean, I remember being very disappointed when then President Obama ejected whatever the number was, 60 plus so-called diplomats, Russian diplomats from the country, and shut down, some kind of facility in Maryland. You know, that was a slap on the wrist of Vladimir Putin compared to the chaos he was able to cause by hacking into the DNC's computer system. And we have never really imposed a cost that would create a deterrent. And I think particularly with people like Putin, and I draw a distinction between the Russians and the Chinese, because the Chinese are doing a lot of theft, right? They're going into our defense contractors and stealing intellectual property. That's a little different than creating political chaos the way Russians are often trying to do. Until Putin understands that there will be a significant cost to be paid, he's going to keep doing it. He's the classic playground bully who doesn't understand anything other than the language of force. And so what does that mean? That means there's a lot of routes you can take here. We should have destroyed network equipment on the part of the GRU or the SVR, the Russian intelligence agencies. We should have messed with the financing. We should have, could have picked a couple of oligarchs and emptied their Swiss bank accounts. Now, I'm saying this a lot more quickly than I should say it, because there's obviously all sorts of equities that you take into account, and you observe things like proportionality. But until Vladimir Putin, when he's asked if the SVR can conduct this operation, has to think, oh my God, the last time that happened, it caused chaos XYZ, he is going to keep doing it. Now, the counter argument, you got me started here. The counter argument has always been, oh, but we're so much more vulnerable, and there'll be a tit for tat, and they're going to take down our networks. Well, what are they going to do? Shut down a gasoline pipeline? So I really do think it is way past time that we use our offensive cyber capabilities to make leaders around the world think two and three times before they do what they're doing otherwise every single day.
So you bring up the problem with our own vulnerability, and obviously, you know, Russia has a $1.7 trillion economy, you know, less than half the size of California's. We have a $20 trillion economy. So we're kind of the biggest glass house in the world. We are a huge economy. We are, as you said, heavily reliant on communications networks and the internet to run our economy. And there are obviously endless opportunities for them to hurt us, and maybe our opportunities to hurt them are not quite as big. So what's to be done?
Yeah, and that's obviously the key question, to which I guess I'd say two things. Number one, it's not self-evident to me that on the chessboard, we're in a much worse position than they are, right? So let's talk about economic and political power in the United States. It is immensely fragmented. There are all kinds of senators, all kinds of members of Congress, governors, mayors, all of whom matter. In Russia, there are probably a handful of people that matter politically. Wealth and the private sector. You know, we have a massively robust private sector where wealth and economic power is highly fragmented and distributed. So it's not clear to me. They have a highly concentrated, I mean, the analogy I would draw is that when you get into a shooting war, you don't want to put all of your tanks in a highly concentrated formation, right? And so it's not immediately clear to me that the chessboard is as grim as perhaps you describe it. Strategically speaking, I do think that there are individuals, businesses, and financing in Russia that are very readily identifiable that we could mess around with in a way that would be very painful and very scary for Putin and his cronies. The other thing I would say is, of course, you do this in a way where you try not to escalate, because yes, a lot of damage could be imposed on our people. We got a little taste of that with the Colonial Pipeline. And so I think what you do is you say, you know, there's a new sheriff in town. You saw what our capabilities are. We don't want this to escalate, but you're going to stop doing this. You are going to stop doing this. And by the way, you observe all of the standards and norms that you observe for offensive activity: proportionality, minimization of collateral damage, etc. So again, I think that's a scary world, but I don't think it's as scary as wondering next Monday what headline I'm going to read about what the FSB or the SVR did that week.
Can I note one news item from mid-July was a distributed denial of service attack on the Russian Ministry of Defense's website. Do you know whether that was something that the U.S. military or government was behind?
Yeah, you're in a realm here where I can't where I can't talk about what I know. Very little is as sensitive as our offensive cyber operations, so I can't go there. However, I will point out, just to be helpful to your larger point, there have been press reports of some of the offensive operations that the NSA Cyber Command were reported to have undertaken that are pretty impressive. Some of the things that they talked about even doing around the election. The point being, we're really, really good at this. And because we're really, really good at this, we should, I think, demonstrate that fact to people who might otherwise think they've got a free pass with us.
Okay. Can I talk why I hope that wasn't a U.S. military operation?
Of course. Of course.
Which is, it's pretty ham-fisted, right? Like DDoS attack on their website. Pretty old school. You know, it's pretty kind of 1999. So I am hoping that when we're projecting forward or defending forward, that that it's not DDoS attacks on Ministry of Defense websites.
Well, I have to be super careful in this realm because since I do get briefed on this stuff, I have to be very careful to not confirm things that are in the press. But let's just say that there is a lot of press out there about, you know, in the last 20 years, some of the things that that we were reputed to have done.
Yes. So. Okay. You know what I'm saying though, right?
We have far more sophisticated people than those who would initiate a DDoS attack.
We talk a lot about Russia, but of course China is doing this stuff, as are countries like North Korea and Iran. Is it basically the same problems, or do we need to be, is it really a different problem set and response for each of these actors? Because we know their motivations are all slightly different, as are their capabilities.
I think of the Chinese and the Russian threats, which I would hold up as the two most significant cyber threats. I think of them very differently. I think of Putin's activities and the Kremlin's activities almost like vandals. You know, sometimes it's just about, you know, leaving that flaming bag of dog poop on your doorstep to show that it can be done, you know, to just to take off your shirt and flex your chest muscles. And that's a little bit of a cartoon, I understand. It is broad-based. It is chest thumping.
Well, the shirt off with the flexing muscles, that's actually not a cartoon.
I use that analogy deliberately. The Chinese, of course, are much more targeted in what they do. There's nothing sort of ego-driven by Chinese intrusions. They are very, very targeted, and primarily around something that we don't do as a country, which is industrial espionage, stealing our secrets and our commercial secrets. And they are exquisitely good at that, unfortunately. And we have not done nearly enough to defend. We also haven't done, if you think about it, that we've talked a lot about deterrence today. You know, that's a little different, right? Because they're not breaking things or, they're actually, stealing plans for XYZ. So, no, I do think of the threats as very, very different and do require a different response. I mean, look, if nothing else, we're in a period of time where there is in Congress, hysteria is too strong a word, but just 24/7 concern about China. And China is a very, very nuanced threat. Right? Because on the one hand, they're doing some awful things that we disapprove of in the cyber realm and in 10 other realms, including the way they treat their own people. But they're, there's not a thing sitting in the room you're sitting in that doesn't have China in its supply chain. They own trillions of dollars of U.S. sovereign debt. That's not true of Russia. So yes, the toolbox and the chessboard are very different.
Let's talk about some of the good news to come out. First of all, we have CISA, and you've talked about maybe a greater role for that agency. Last week, they came out with a new platform for federal agencies to use to do vulnerability disclosure programs. And I'm actually working on a story about some of the fruit that has already borne of federal agencies putting up vulnerability disclosure programs, inviting independent security researchers to come in and kind of poke around and see if they can find security holes and stuff like that. So CISA is doing a great job. What would you like to see happen with that particular agency?
Well, great point. And I'm delighted to see that all of this churning in the Senate with the infrastructure bills and reconciliation bills, everybody is talking about more resources for not just CISA, but all of the government's cybersecurity efforts. So what would I like to see? Number one, by the way, we've got a lot of work to do to get our own house in order. We've taken some steps inside the federal government, but even in the most sensitive networks, we constantly see intrusions. And so we've got a lot of work to do before we start telling other people what they need to do in securing our most sensitive national security secrets. And I can't get into how successful, sadly, some of our opponents have been at getting inside there, but you know about this stuff because, you remember the SF-86 intrusion and all of that stuff. So we've got a lot of work to do to demonstrate and to use best practices inside the federal government. And then the other thing I would highlight is that, I was a veteran of the CISA Act legislation. I think it was 2015, where we fought this huge fight to get to start the process of getting, I keep using the word crowdsourcing, of getting the three-letter agencies working with the private sector. We've got a long way to go to make sure that there is probably 24/7 interaction and sharing of information. Again, with care. We don't want the NSA or the FBI having spreadsheets of Americans' personally identifiable information. But I just don't see a world where we don't have all of the experts working in real time, because the threats are constant. The threats are real time. And so I do think both internally in our own house, but also externally, setting up a regime where we are working together on a 24/7 basis is where we need to go.
Just give me your thoughts on the infrastructure deal. It's percolating its way through Congress. What's in there vis-a-vis cybersecurity, and is it enough?
Yeah, great question. Great last question, actually. So, I think of this deal as the bill is good for two reasons. Number one, it's really well targeted, and that means that lots of people think there's stuff in there that there should be, and some who think that it's too big, etc. But look, it's I think of it as a 21st century bill, and what I mean by that, it's heavy on transit. Relatively speaking, lighter on bridges and highways, but it's very heavy on mass transit, which is the future of travel in certain certainly in denser, more densely populated areas.
Amen.
It's very heavy on broadband. And of course, this points in the direction of what we're talking about right now, making sure that, you know, like the Tennessee Valley Authority, you know, provided electricity for the American South back in the 1930s, that, you know, every American is going to have access to broadband. And then, as I mentioned before, it has good resources for the federal government's effort to secure those the networks behind all of that. So yeah, and the other thing I mentioned, there were two things that got me excited about it, in addition to the 21st century aspect, the fact that it's going to be bipartisan. I guess I'm a little old school, and I saw what happened on January 6th, and I think Americans really need to see that the two parties can come together to pass something big and meaningful. That's going to be, I think, a gift to our to our otherwise somewhat tattered democracy.
I agree with you on that. Representative Himes, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks very much. Look forward to coming back at some point.
We've been speaking with Jim Himes. He's a U.S. representative for Connecticut's 4th District. He was here talking to us about the changing thinking on Capitol Hill when it comes to cybersecurity and cyber risk.